Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, December 1st, 2022. Flu shot and COVID booster availability in the Big Bend region by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Tri-County. Local healthcare entities are continuing to offer flu and COVID-19 booster shots as an increase in illnesses spikes during the winter weather and holiday season. Dr. Christy Alexander of the Marfa Country Clinic said in addition to COVID and the flu, the common cold and strep throat are also currently making their rounds in the community, likely due to the colder weather and people gathering closely indoors and traveling for the holidays. The Marfa Country Clinic recently ran out of flu shots but may order more, said Alexander. In general, she encouraged people to still seek out flu shots if they have not yet had one this season. Alexander explained that flu season lasts until the months of April and May each year, typically peaking around December and February. We're getting through one of the peaks now where we have seen a lot of flu. If predictions prevail, we'll see another bump in February. So it's really never too late to get it, said Alexander. The Marfa Country Clinic is not currently offering COVID boosters, but Alexander said her staff is pointing patients to the Texas Department of State Health Services in Marfa for their COVID vaccines and boosters, and to call ahead on Thursdays when they offer the immunizations. Alexander said the best COVID booster available for those in need is the bivalent booster, which specifically protects against the now dominant Omicron variant of the virus as well as other strains. It is the one to get now, whether you've been boosted before or not. Go ahead and get that one, because it's covering more strains, said Alexander. Alexander said while it is safe to receive the flu and COVID booster shots simultaneously, the double dose may result in more physical fatigue. In order to stay in good health this holiday season, Alexander recommended familiar, yet effective preventative measures be taken. Wearing masks, good hand washing, all of those preventive measures still prevail. There's nothing new and improved. Stay well, get good sleep, good rest. Just taking those added precautions that we started really ramping up when COVID first came on the scene, said Alexander. Howland Drug in Alpine also reported an influx of patients with the flu and other illnesses, according to their pharmacist. They still have a stock of flu shots and various COVID boosters available, including regular flu shots and high-dose flu shots, recommended for those 65 and older. First and second doses of COVID vaccines, bivalent boosters, Moderna and Pfizer boosters, as well as Pfizer boosters for children 5 to 12, are available. Walk-ins are welcome, with Highland Drug staff recommending calling ahead to confirm their hours at 432-837-3931. Prescription Shop Alpine is also taking walk-in appointments with primary availability on Fridays. They are offering regular and high-dose flu shots as well as bivalent, Moderna, and Pfizer COVID booster shots for adults. Those seeking more information can call 432-837-3498. Preventative Care Health Services recommends patients call to make appointments for COVID booster shots, but walk-ins or appointments are welcome for flu shots. All three PCHS locations are offering the flu shot. The Alpine location is offering COVID boosters the last Thursday of the month from 10 a.m. to 11:45 a.m. for adults and from 3 to 4:45 p.m. for children. The Marfa location currently does not have a stock of COVID boosters and is awaiting a shipment. The Presidio location is offering booster shots on Mondays from 10 a.m. to noon for adults and from 1 to 2 p.m. for children. Alpine and Presidio locations have bivalent and Moderna boosters for adults and Pfizer boosters for children. For more information, call 432-837-4812. Staff photo by Allegra Hobbs. Republicans Royce Laskowski, left, and Roy Hurley, right, each unseated Democratic incumbents to win seats on Jeff Davis County Commissioner's Court. The court is now entirely made up of Republicans. With election victories, Republicans solidify hold in Jeff Davis County. By Allegra Hobbs, A-L-L-E-G-R-A at BigBendSentinel.com. Jeff Davis County. When newly elected members of the Jeff Davis County Commissioner's Court are sworn in at the start of the new year, it will signal a notable shift in the local political landscape. For the first time, the governing entity will be made up entirely of Republicans. While rumors of a red wave across the state of Texas and nationwide may have been exaggerated, it is no exaggeration in the politically split rural county. In the November midterms, two longtime Democratic incumbents, the only Democrats out of the four commissioners, were ousted by Republican challengers by slim margins. Fort Davis Fire Marshal Roy Hurley won against Todd Jagger by 8 votes in the race to represent Precinct 2. Rancher Royce Laskowski beat out Albert Miller, who has held the position since 2007, by a mere 5 votes. I'm sitting here wondering, my God, we have a clean sweep in this county, marveled Bob Gray, chair of the Jeff Davis County Republican Party as of last year. In addition to the county's few contested races going to Republicans, Republican incumbents faced uncontested races in this year's election. County Judge Curtis Evans, Justice of the Peace Marianne Ludecky, County Treasurer Don Kitts, County Clerk Jennifer Wright, and the remaining commissioners will all keep their seats. It is the culmination of a gradual rightward shift, at least in party affiliation, if not in ideology, that party leaders have witnessed over the last few years. When the late Bob Rose took on the role of the county's Republican Party chair about a decade ago, the party didn't have much of a presence to speak of in the county, recalled his wife, Linda Rose. Bob Rose sought to change that. He knew that in Jeff Davis County, as with other far west Texas counties, many Democrats by name held conservative politics. Running as a Republican, at the time, simply seemed out of the question. Once he got elected, he started talking to people and found out that there were a lot of conservative people, and some of them weren't running as Republicans because they thought, if I run on the Republican Party, I won't get elected, said Linda Rose. So he says, well, you gotta run on the Republican Party. You are definitely conservative in your beliefs. He convinced a lot of people to do just that, and lo and behold, they started getting elected, and we started winning the county over. Democrat Todd Jagger said the move towards electing Republicans to local office was a departure from the Jeff Davis County he first moved to in the early 90s. Politically, when I moved out here over three decades ago, there was not a Republican primary. Everybody ran as a Democrat. "I don't think anybody ran as a Republican," he said. "I recall everybody running as a Democrat, no matter what their political philosophy may be." And in rural Far West Texas, the Democratic Party affiliation does not signal progressive politics. Jagger himself identified as a conservative and said he believes his record on the court reflects a conservatism in the way old-school Democrats would be. The real shift seemed to occur sometime between 2016 and 2018, said Linda Rose. She attributes an increased identification with the Republican Party to the popularity of Donald Trump, who handily won the majority of votes in Jeff Davis County, both in 2016 and 2020. The numbers do not necessarily indicate Trump enjoyed unprecedented local popularity, however. A higher percentage of voters in the county cast their ballots for Republican candidates between 2000 and 2012. When it comes to presidential elections, Jeff Davis County has been reliably red since 1980. Numbers aside, local Republicans pointed to a shift in attitude that is more difficult to quantify. Rose said she saw an unprecedented enthusiasm for Trump among county residents that she believes snowballed into state and local politics, recalling a well-attended Trump rally in Fort Davis in 2020. "Trump was the first time the party spelled out exactly what they were for," she said. "Before, it was kind of wishy-washy, and in fact, when I was growing up, there was very little difference between the parties, but he really kind of spelled it out." Hurley agreed. His own mother, a lifelong Democrat, had voted for Trump, even going so far as to say she would never again cast her ballot for a Democratic candidate. "I think that made a big change on everybody, seeing that we don't have a politician. We have a working person that's willing to make a change in our country. That's what made my mom change, who was a Democrat for 65 years, said Hurley. Miller, for his part, having lost his position of 16 years to a Republican newcomer, echoed this exact sentiment when asked what he thought was behind the local red wave. "Our former president has a lot to do with it," he said, "and I think it is happening. There are more and more Republicans, and they're more active." Though it does not necessarily follow that a preference for Republican candidates in national elections, which Jeff Davis County has maintained for over 40 years, would bleed into local politics, which tend to be more purple on the county level, the local Republicans were making an argument that had also been put forth by statewide operatives. Governor Greg Abbott himself has insisted that former Democrats running for local office are defecting due to a frustration with the broader party line. In Presidio County, County Judge Cinderella Guevara served as a case study in this defection. She said the Democratic Party did not reflect her values, pointing specifically to the issue of abortion. Pat Parks of Project Red Texas, a political action committee devoted to flipping blue counties at the local level, had previously told the Big Bend Sentinel that she believed Texans were leaving the Democratic Party over a frustration with an increasingly leftist platform. Gray said that he believes this is the case. "This last year and a half, I think there's been actions taken by the party in power in Washington that are contrary to the values of the people that live in this area," said Gray. When asked which issues specifically he thinks embody this, he pointed to the perceived inaction by the Biden administration at the border. The question of the Texas-Mexico border's security is one of great concern to Jeff Davis County voters, said Gray. Laskowski agreed it was a concern he had heard from voters in his precinct. Jagger said he did believe the Democratic Party had failed to effectively reach rural voters, and in a two-party system which doesn't offer abundant alternatives, that could lead one to vote for the opposing party. I honestly believe it has hurt us in rural Texas, the fact that they have not articulated a message that makes many people feel included out here, he said. I'm not blaming the Democratic Party for my loss. At the end of the day, our campaigns are up to us. Laskowski and Hurley both say they ran intentional, on-the-ground campaigns in an effort to sway voters. Hurley is already a known public figure, both as fire marshal and proprietor of the Harvard Hotel, but he also went door-to-door and spoke to voters at community hubs like the supermarket and the post office. Laskowski and his wife Susan went door-to-door in remote Valentine, which falls in his precinct, to connect with residents. He also benefited from the help of Project Red Texas, which gave him several dozen yard signs that were spread across the county. The PAC also paid for his candidate filing fee. Hurley's campaign was already underway by the time they reached out. Whether or not ideological divisions are driving a rightward shift, ultimately, many issues that matter to the local county voter are divorced from party affiliation or ideology. Those issues could be as small as a stop sign in need of repair, said Hurley, or they could be as life and death as emergency response times in the vast region. The work before the commissioners is that of listening to each constituent, they said, and finding solutions that will make a material difference. This is a huge rural county, and our sheriff's department is small, said Laskowski. We've got one guy on patrol during the day, and he may be an hour or more away from town, and something happens here. We need help. It's just a matter of trying to help give people something back for the taxes they have been paying. Newly published archaeological findings complicate narrative of Porvenir Massacre by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio County. In September, an archaeological paper was published that could challenge the prevailing narrative of the Porvenir Massacre, the extrajudicial killing of 15 men and boys of Mexican descent in Presidio County in 1918. The findings outlined the exact site of the massacre and doubled the number of artifacts that remain from the tragic night, suggesting the United States military was more involved than previously thought. Senior project archaeologist David Keller of the Center for Big Bend Studies authored the paper, with help in the field from a small team of Big Bend locals. The project was privately funded and kicked off in 2015. This project represents the first and only archaeological investigation of this important site and challenges the long-standing historical record in presenting material evidence that suggests military involvement, Keller wrote in his abstract. Porvenir was a small community near the Rio Grande, north of Candelaria and southwest of Valentine. In the early 20th century, its 100-odd residents were primarily landowners and their families, who raised crops and cattle of their own, as well as serving as hired hands on Presidio County's larger ranches. The town's demographics were almost entirely Mexican. The only white man in Porvenir was the school teacher. Those demographics made Porvenir an easy target during the waning days of the Mexican Revolution, when numerous cross-border raids earned the region a reputation as the Bloody Bend. Many of the larger, more prosperous settlements, like Candelaria and Marfa, were dominated by white land and business owners who set the tone for local politics and racial mores. On Christmas Day, 1917, Mexican bandits attacked the Bright Ranch outside of Marfa. The Bright Ranch was home to a general store that served the more remote reaches of Presidio County. The raiders made off with as many stolen goods as they could, and the U.S. cavalry pursued them all the way into Polaris, Chihuahua, where 18 of the raiders were killed. The Bright Ranch raid was widely used to defend the tragic events in Porvenir just a few weeks later. On January 28, 1918, as the story goes, each household in Porvenir was woken up by a posse of Texas Rangers and local ranchers who rounded up the men and teenage boys and shot them at close range. The entire bluff was stained with blood and human tissue, wrote historian Monica Munoz Martinez in her book, The Injustice Never Leaves You. Martinez's research involved tracking down relatives and descendants of the victims of the massacre. The descendants ultimately applied for a historical marker through the Texas Historical Commission's Undertold Markers Program, which aims to fill historical gaps and highlight the history of the state's minority communities. Securing a highway marker for Porvenir was a battle on its own. Several local ranching families and the Presidio County Historical Commission opposed the text of the marker and stalled its installation, concerned that the marker was a form of weaponized identity politics by militant Hispanics. 4 years later, the marker was officially unveiled along Highway 90 between Marfa and Valentine in November of 2018. The controversy over the marker highlighted stark contrasts in how the event is remembered, or more frequently forgotten, by different factions in Presidio County. Keller expressed the same concerns at the outset of the project. The project was initially approached with the assumption that the site's integrity had been seriously compromised and that most of the massacre artifacts had already been collected, he wrote. Both the descendants of local ranching families and the descendants of the men killed at Porvenir agree that Company B of the Texas Rangers was heavily involved. Governor Hobby disbanded the company, and the massacre was a part of a larger investigation into ranger misconduct that ultimately bore no consequences for anyone involved. The prevailing narrative is that the rangers and the ranchers were escorted to the scene by a group of 12 soldiers from Group G of the 8th Cavalry, but that the cavalrymen didn't commit the actual murders. The soldiers returned a few days later and torched the abandoned settlement. The widows and children left behind went into hiding across the river, where they buried their family members and neighbors in a mass grave. The findings of Keller's team turned that narrative on its head. The catalog of artifacts from the investigation revealed that around 20% of the bullets and casings found at the scene came from civilian firearms, and 61% came from military-issued firearms. An additional handful of artifacts require further study, but the researchers believe that these may also have come from military-grade weapons. In an interview with the Texas Standard, Keller cautioned against using his findings as a smoking gun. More research is needed before the narrative can officially be rewritten. The dig site, a 100-year-old cold crime scene, still contains many mysteries that may never be solved. Many, if not most, of the bullets remained in the victims, he wrote. To know for sure, The team would have to locate and exhume the mass grave across the river, which comes with its own complications. Beyond the question of getting the necessary permits from the Mexican government, Keller expressed moral opposition to that project. He didn't see the point when the manner of death was well established and hesitated to inflict additional suffering onto the descendants of the massacre. Even with these larger questions looming in the background, the team felt that healing progress had been made. The archaeological findings confirmed a story that many descendants had been quietly holding for the past century and acknowledged the terrible loss of human life and the intergenerational trauma that it spawned. Keller wrote, "In this way, the project contributed to a larger reckoning with structural violence towards people of Mexican descent that has been endemic to the borderlands for generations."
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, December 1st, 2022. County gives $500,000 to PCMH by Sean Yorks. The Pecos County Commissioners Court on November 28th declared an emergency and fronted Pecos County Memorial Hospital an additional $550,000 in operating funds. Hospital CEO Betsy Briscoe said the hospital will need the funds to cover payroll on December 7th. "We do have enough in the bank right at the moment, but that payroll is going to come up in between now and the next Commissioners Court," Briscoe said, adding that the hospital received some payments November 17th, but hasn't received any big dollar payments. "That's the hard part about this, is I'm not sure where we're going to be between now and the 7th. If we do, it'll cover it, but if we don't, it won't. That's the hard part with all this." The court voted to amend the budget for the additional operating funds for the hospital. In other hospital-related action, Briscoe reported overtime of 463 hours, or $17,154, and accounts payable at $622,000. Briscoe said the hospital is still waiting for the final damage report from the October 10th flood so that they can send the repairs out for bid. The county treasurer reported election overtime from October 16th to November 15th, totaling $648, EMS part-time overtime at $300, full-time EMS overtime at $25,575, comp and vacation pay for a Sheriff's Department employee who left November 15th was $5,672, vacation, comp ad, straight time payout for an adult probation employee who left on November 10th was $986, and another adult probation employee who left on November 9th was $331. Precinct 4 water straight pay and overtime from October 29th to November 11th was $402. Vector spray pay was $815. Straight time and vacation pay for a Precinct 1 employee who left November 15th was $3,456. Pecos County and Terrell County enter into an aid agreement by Sean Yorks. The Pecos County Commissioners Court on November 28th approved a mutual aid agreement between the Pecos County Sheriff's Department and the Terrell County Sheriff's Department. Terrell County, which borders Pecos to the east and Mexico to the south, has had a high increase in illegal immigrants coming through the county. "We had an agreement with Terrell County years ago," Sheriff T.J. Perkins said. "The agreement will allow deputies from both departments to work together as requested in investigations of criminal activity in either county." The court also came to an agreement with Travelers Insurance for two hail-damaged police vehicles, a 2016 Ford Taurus and a 2003 Ford Van. The Taurus only has 64,000 miles on it and received dents and shattered windshield in the October 10th storm. The county accepted $6,564 to keep the Taurus and make repairs and $4,500 to total out the van. The court approved an election services contract between Pecos County and the Buena Vista Independent School District. County Clerk Liz Chapman provided the polling places and arranged for their use for the BVISD election, provided the election kits and voting machines. The county paid the early voting and election day clerk and judges, and the school district paid a fee for use of the voting machines. ES&S programmed the balance, charged the county, and the county charged the school district for its portion of any costs associated with the programming. The court approved a predator control report from the Wildlife Services. The county paid $1,800 to Transpacus Avian to remove two coyotes from the local ranches. The court approved a request for funds from the Pecos County EMS for fuel. According to the EMS director, gas prices have doubled since the beginning of the year. The court approved whatever amount the EMS would need for the remainder of the year. County farmers and ranchers are reminded to vote. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has started mailing ballots for the Farm Service Agency County Committee elections to be eligible farmers and ranchers across the country. To be counted, ballots must be returned to the Pecos County FSA office or postmarked by December 5th. FSA County Committee members provide valuable knowledge and judgment as decisions are made about the services we provide, including disaster and safety net programs, said Carla Spencer, County Executive Director for Pecos County. Please take a few minutes to review your ballot and make your selection prior to the December 5th deadline. Each committee has from 3 to 11 elected members who serve 3-year terms of office, and at least one seat is up for election each year for a certain local administrative area. Newly elected committee members will take office January 1, 2023. Pecos County Committee members help FSA make important decisions on its commodity support programs, conservation programs, indemnity and disaster programs, and emergency programs and eligibility. LAA1 Paul Gallagher is nominated for representing the southwestern quarter of Pecos County to serve as a committee member for a 3-year term. Gallagher is a cow-calf operator who, if elected, will be serving his first term. LAA2, Todd Suter and Wayne Tinkler have been nominated, representing the northwest quarter of Pecos County, to serve as committee member for a 3-year term. Todd Suter is a forage producer and livestock operator that is currently serving the 3rd year of his first term. Wayne Tinkler is a cow-calf operator who, if elected, will be serving his first term. LAA3, Cade Schneidman, is nominated to represent the northeastern quarter of Pecos County to serve as a committee member for a 3-year term. Schneeman is a livestock producer who, if elected, will be serving his first term. Producers must participate or cooperate in a program to be eligible to vote in the county committee election. A cooperating producer is someone who has provided information about their farming or ranching operation, but may not have applied or received FSA program benefits. Also, for county committee elections, producers who are not of a legal voting age but supervise and conduct the farming operations of an entire farm are eligible to vote. Producers can find out if their LAA is up for election and if they are eligible to vote by contacting their local county office. Eligible voters who do not receive a ballot in the mail can request one from their local county office. Visit fsa.usda.gov/elections for more information. Production of A Christmas Story begins December 8th. The Paisano Players production of A Christmas Story, adapted by Philip Grecian and directed by Reba Subia and Stacy Scheinfeld, will be Thursday, December 8th at 7 p.m. at the Nelson Street Theater. Other performances will be Friday, December 9th at 7 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday, December 10th and 11th at 2. Tickets are available for purchase with credit card online, or tickets will be available at the door for cash or check. Tickets are $10 for adults and $5 for students and seniors 65 and older. Also, don't miss the big Christmas cookie sale in the FMH Meeting Hall on Saturday and Sunday afternoons from 12:30 to 1:45. For more information, call Alice Dirksen at 336-3180. the most wonderful time of the year. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas in Fort Stockton, and the holiday season truly kicks off this weekend with holiday activities across the city. The Fort Stockton Chamber of Commerce kicked things off November 28th with the Joy Run Silent Auction and Art Show, which runs through December 9th, and the annual Christmas Parade takes place on Friday, December 2nd at 6:30. The Joy Run Silent Auction is for good cause to get everyone in the giving spirit. The silent auction is to buy Christmas presents for the nursing home, said Chamber Director Arna McCorkle. We decided to do that since a lot of the other organizations have toys for tots, and we didn't want to leave our elderly people out. That's what we do. We buy presents for them, and we take them out there to them. The Chamber will have an open house on Thursday, December 1st from 5 to 7 p.m., where the community can enjoy the art show, bid on the silent auction, and talk to the Pecos County Memorial Hospital Board and CEO about the upcoming election. Some of the hospital board and Betsy and CEO will be here to explain about the hospital district. There's some misconceptions about how much it's going to cost. She said the maximum tax is 75 cents, but the hospital is thinking 22 cents. That's the one thing we really want people to understand, that it's not going to double your taxes. Yes, it's going to add to it, but it's going to keep us a hospital. On Friday, December 2nd, the Feast of Sharing will be held at the Pecos County Convention Center from 11 to 1. The fire department and several other departments go out and raise funds, and they cook a free turkey and dressing dinner for anybody that wants to come. They usually serve a lot of people, like 1,000 or so. It's a good thing that they do. The theme of this year's Christmas parade is a Texas Christmas. The parade is free to enter, but registration deadline is Thursday at noon. The parade will line up at 5:30 at the Old Comanche School and travel east on Dickinson, then south on Main. Candy, small soft toys, and other items to be given to spectators are allowed, but may not be thrown from vehicles. Items must be given to spectators away from moving vehicles. Trophies will be awarded for best walking, best driving float motorized, best riding non-motorized, and best overall. No Santas will be allowed, as the Chamber already has its official Santa in the parade. The Annie Riggs Museum will have Annie's Christmas welcome and pictures with the Grinch from 5:30 to 8:30 on Friday, and Breakfast with Santa takes place Saturday from 8:30 to 11 at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, November 24th. Bustos Meza accused of conspiring to distribute cocaine. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahan's News has learned more details on the simultaneous drug raids conducted in Monahan's and Thorntonville early last Tuesday morning. The raids led to the arrest of two Monahan's men, Anthony Bustos Sr. and Daniel Ochoa Meza, along with six others, none of which are from Monahan's. Members of the Drug Enforcement Administration and the U.S. Marshals conducted the searches jointly in the 1500 block of South Allen Street and in the 700 block of Wilma Street in Thorntonville. According to an indictment handed down by the United States District Court Western District Pecos Division on November 11th, Meza, Bustos, and the six other individuals are charged on six separate counts, including conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute cocaine, aiding and abetting, and possession with intent to distribute cocaine. The indictment states, on or about August 20th, 2021, Bustos, Meza, and the six others knowingly conspired and agreed to possess with intent to distribute a mixture or substance containing cocaine. Both Bustos and Meza are being charged with possessing 500 grams, 1.1 pounds or more, of cocaine. The indictment also asked for the forfeiture of properties located at 1511 South Bruce, 701 South Wilma, two properties in Anthony, New Mexico, and a 2021 Chevrolet Silverado Duramax. A motion to deny bond for Bustos and Meza was filed and set for Tuesday, November 29th in Alpine, before Judge David B. Fannin. The motion to deny bond is based on the two being flight risk, posing a danger to the community, and the case involves an offense for which a maximum term of imprisonment of 10 years or more is prescribed in the Controlled Substances Act and other federal acts. It was not known as of press time if bond was denied. Bustos and Meza have a plea deadline of December 28th, and if no plea is reached, trial is set for January 17th. Quakes shake the basin. The area west of Mentone in Reeves County was shaken Wednesday and Thursday, with 40 earthquakes reported in less than 24 hours. The biggest quake of them all was the 5.4 magnitude quake that was felt as far away as Midland, San Antonio, and Ciudad Juarez, according to reports, including one from the Associated Press. It was the third strongest earthquake in the state's history. The series of tremors, specifically the 5.4 magnitude quake, was enough for the Railroad Commission to announce it was deploying inspectors to Reeves County. The strongest of all the tremors on Wednesday was the strongest recorded in the lower 48 states this calendar year. Quote, "The agency is monitoring seismic data from the United States Geological Survey, the TexNet Seismic Monitoring Program, and private operator monitoring stations, and will take any actions necessary to protect public safety and the environment," the Railroad Commission stated in a news release on Thursday. Continuing the quote, "The Railroad Commission inspectors are examining disposal activity at injection wells in the area, and staff is also reviewing permit requirements and operator seismic response plans in the northern Culberson-Reeves seismic response area," end quote. The quakes took place in relatively the same area west-southwest of Mentone. The first quake, the 5.4 magnitude earthquake, took place 25 miles west-southwest of Mentone around 3:22 p.m. 31 quakes ranging from 1.9 to 4.1 in magnitude were reported between 3:39 and 7:49 p.m., according to the USGS. At 9:54 p.m., the quakes returned ranging from 2.1 to 3.8 in magnitude. The last seven earthquakes, including the five that took place Thursday through 3 p.m., were less than magnitude 3.0, according to EarthquakeTrack.com. The same site showed 42 quakes had taken place within the last 24 hours of the 5.4 magnitude quake. It also showed 70 quakes within the last 7 days, 199 in the past 30 days, and 1,668 in the past 365 days. TexNet, the Texas State Earthquake Monitoring Network, stated the following about the seismic activity. Quote, "We are still investigating the data associated with these seismic events," said Scott W. Tinker, the state geologist of Texas and the director of the Bureau of Economic Geology. Continuing the quote, "Our first concern, of course, is for any people who might have been affected by these earthquakes. The professional scientists on the TexNet team, led by Alexandros Savatis, are working diligently to analyze the data that we have received from the TexNet network of monitoring stations," end quote. The Associated Press reported Thursday that State Representative Eddie Morales Jr., whose district includes Mentone, said he spoke with authorities and there were no reported injuries. He said via Twitter that state officials will be inspecting roads, bridges, and other infrastructure as a precaution. In March, the Reporter Telegram reported Permian Basin oil and gas operators have teamed up with the Railroad Commission in crafting a plan to address the growing rate and intensity of seismicity in the area. The first-of-its-kind operator-led response plan, the Northern Culberson Reefs Seismic Response Area, was being implemented by the Commission. The plan has a goal of reducing the intensity and frequency of earthquakes, including eliminating 3.5 magnitude or greater earthquakes by the end of 2023. Quote, based on the reviews and meetings with operators, action will be taken on steps outlined in the operator-led response plan, the Railroad Commission stated. Actions outlined in the plan include, but are not limited to, expanding SRA boundaries and further reducing injection volumes. Quote, the OLRP requires all deep disposal wells within a 9-kilometer boundary in the SRA to shut in for 24 months if a magnitude 4.5 or greater earthquake occurs within the boundary. There are no active deep disposal wells within the 9-kilometer boundary. Reduction of injection volume from shallow disposal wells has occurred based on the schedule contained in the OLRP. The Commission also stated there is a potential lag time between changes in injection rates and changes in seismicity varies. Quote, historical activity indicates a potential lag time of 12 to 18 months, the Railroad Commission stated. The Railroad Commission staff will continue its work and oversight toward reducing earthquakes in that region to keep residents and the environment safe. End quote. Love at First Sight. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. Tommy Wooten's life changed forever the night he parked his big rig at the Holiday Inn in Scottsboro, Alabama. Vita Maculier was the desk clerk on duty that night in late October of 1972, when Wooten walked through the door. Quote, I immediately just knew she was the one, the right one, the special one. Her smile captured my heart, and it was all wrapped up and done, Tommy said. Quote, I felt the same way, Vita said. I knew we were supposed to be together. End quote. That night led to a 50-year marriage that is still going strong. Over the next couple of days, Tommy and Vita went out to eat and took in a movie. Tommy made a cross-country haul out to the West Coast and got back to Alabama as fast as he could. Quote, I got a speeding ticket driving back to Alabama to be with her, Wooten said. Tommy and Vita both knew exactly what they wanted, and they got married on November 9th, only 2 weeks after meeting each other. Quote, Alabama had a 3-day waiting period, so we went across the state line to Trenton, Georgia, to get married. In Georgia, a couple could get their blood test, their marriage license, and get married all in the same day, Vita said. Many states required a blood test to get married and had a 3-day waiting period before a marriage license would be issued. A few states didn't require a waiting period. Georgia was one of those. Tommy and Vita immediately returned to Alabama as a married couple. Tommy headed to the West Coast the next day with a load on his truck. Both Tommy and Vita had been previously married, with Vita bringing 3 children, Ricky, Regina, and Michelle, to her union with Tommy, who adopted them and raised them as his own. They bounced around for a few years, spending time in places like California and Corpus Christi. Quote, while we were living in Corpus Christi, we were blessed with 2 more beautiful girls, Melissa, born in 1973, and Christy, born in 74, Tommy said. The family moved to Monahans the first time in 1978. While living in Monahans at that time, Tommy worked for Halliburton and Cox Transport. Vita enrolled in nursing school at Odessa College. She started school there on the OC campus, but later moved to the OC Extension campus in Kermit, where she graduated as an LVN. The family left Monahans to resettle in Rankin, where Tommy went to work for Western Company as a cement sales representative until they went out of business. Quote, I decided to start a completely different career, so I enrolled in Odessa College's law enforcement course, Wooten said. After completing the law enforcement course, he went to work for the Crockett County Sheriff's Department in Ozona. Tommy spent the next 5 years there before moving over to Sonora's Sutton County Sheriff's Department. When the couple first moved to Rankin, Vita was hired by the Rankin Hospital, where she began her 36-year-long career as a nurse. Quote, I worked for the Rankin Hospital for 20 years while Tommy did his thing, Vita laughed. After 10 years in law enforcement, Tommy decided to go back to truck driving. Quote, I went to work for Rankin Oil Company, driving an oil tanker, and Vita was driving back and forth to Rankin, Tommy said. During this time, as an oil hauler, Tommy made the major decision to become his own boss by buying his own truck and started cross-country driving again. Tommy hauled shelf-stable food items from coast to coast. Cross-country truck drivers are away from home for long periods of time, so Vita took a break from nursing and in 1989 went to truck driving school. Quote, I figured if I learned to drive a truck, I could spend more time with Tommy and we could switch drivers during the really long hauls, Vita said. Vita got her truck driving license, but driving across the country with Tommy did not work the way she had originally planned. Quote, I hated it, Vita said. It was like riding in a log wagon, end quote. The couple located in the Austin area, and Vita went back to nursing at Western Nursing Home in Georgetown. Tommy quit driving for trucking companies and bought his own car hauling truck. He was hauling repossessed cars for finance companies in the Austin area. This worked for a while. Between the two, they were making a living. But when the Texas recession hit in 2009, Tommy and Vita suffered a serious financial downfall. Quote, we couldn't make the truck and house payments. We lost everything, house, truck, everything, Tommy said. This is when the couple moved back to Monahans in 2011 and moved in with their daughter and son-in-law, Tommy and Regina Acosta. Tommy worked in security for Village Farms while the facility was under construction, and Vita did sewing for the public. Vita also followed the craft fair circuit, selling her homemade crafts. Through the years, the couple had to test the strength of their bond and commitment to each other, but they never thought about giving up. The couple recently renewed their wedding vows on their golden anniversary during a ceremony held at Spring Creek Marina in San Angelo, with their grandson, Christopher Smith, performing the ceremony for them. Quote, Christopher took an online certification course to become a wedding officiant just so he could officiate for our wedding, Tommy said. We wanted everyone to know that there's never been a single doubt about our love for each other. Vita is still the girl I want, Tommy said. 11 Monahans High School students inducted into National Honor Society. 11 students from Monahans High School were inducted into membership of the National Honor Society in an evening ceremony at the high school auditorium on Monday, November 14th. Members were selected by the MHS Faculty Advisory Council for meeting high standards of scholarship, service, leadership, and character. Each of these components define the true purpose of the organization. New inductees were sophomores Jaden Hernandez and Bethany Sanchez, juniors Alexis Armendariz, David Carrasco, Laura Curiardo, Shannon Lawson, Lucas McNeely, and Brayden Milliron. Seniors Haley Brito, Brooklyn Kesey, and Natalie Hernandez. New officers for the 2022-2023 school year are President Fisher Boone, Vice President Mia Mata, Secretary Kaylee Holin, Treasurer Brisa Armendariz, and Parliamentarian Mackenzie Burkett. Quote, "I can't speak highly enough about each of these students, new and current. Each one of these students put forth the effort to be where they are. As a group, they are striving to get involved in the community while obtaining educational excellence. Feeling blessed to be a part of such a high standard at Monahans High School," Brooke Reese, chapter advisor, said. "Including our newly inducted members, there are currently a total of 19 current members. The National Honor Society ranks as one of the oldest and most prestigious national organizations for high school students. For 100 years, the organization has been a pioneer among student groups in the United States by using a unique, forward-thinking lens to recognize students for far more than academia. Chapters exist in three-fourths of the nation's high schools, and since 1921, millions of students have been selected for membership. Thousands of dollars in scholarships have been awarded to senior members since 1945 by the sponsoring organization, the National Association of Secondary School Principals. As we look to the future, the National Honor Society will continue pushing the boundaries of student development to serve as a champion of growth and achievement for the entire learning community."
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.